Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, your portal to the past. If you're like me and can't get enough of untold stories and forgotten tales, you're in for a treat. Newspapers.com has nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers dating back to the 1690s, and you can search them all in seconds. It's a treasure trove waiting for curious minds like yours. And with papers from across the US, UK, Canada, Australia, and beyond, Newspapers.com is the ultimate resource to unearth the stories that shaped our world. And here's something special for our history-loving listeners. Newspapers.com is offering an exclusive discount. Use the code HISTORYUNPLUGGED and get 20% off your subscription. That's promo code HISTORYUNPLUGGED, one word, at Newspapers.com. It's like having your own time machine to explore the stories that made history come alive. One more time, HISTORYUNPLUGGED, promo code at Newspapers.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the early 1800s, the Cherokee Nation had a terrible choice to make. It was clear that the white settlers were not going to leave, and the Cherokee people did not have the ability to resist them. The American government gave them a choice. Go west and abandon their ancestral homelands. They can continue to be the Cherokee people, but this is a land they had no connection to, and all their knowledge about forest life would be irrelevant there. Or they could stay in their homeland, but they had to stop being Cherokee. They had abandoned their religion, their way of dress, their customs. They had to till the soil, adopt Christianity, use a written language, send their kids to school, and assimilate. In the middle of this choice about what to do with the future of their people, emerged a terrible rivalry between two Cherokee leaders. This led to a century-long blood feud between two chiefs whose mutual hatred shaped the history of Cherokee tribal society far more than anyone, even the reviled President Andrew Jackson. Today, I'm talking with author John Sedgwick, who wrote a book called Blood Moon, An American Epic of War and Splendor in the Cherokee Nation. He writes about these two chiefs, John Ross and The Ridge. The Ridge, which is short for He Who Walks on Mountains, was a Cherokee chief who lived from 1771 to 1839. He spoke no English, but whose exploits on the battlefield were legendary. John Ross lived from 1790 to 1866 and was the Cherokee's primary chief for nearly 40 years. It spoke not a word of Cherokee and proudly displayed the Scottish side of his mixed-blood heritage. He was sort of the diplomat of the Cherokee people to Washington. To protect their land holdings from American encroachment, these two men negotiated with almost every American president from George Washington through Abraham Lincoln. At first friends and allies, they worked together to establish the Cherokee Nation of 1827. But the two broke on the subject of removal. The Ridge believed resisting President Jackson and his army would be hopeless, while Ross wanted to stay and fight for the lands the Cherokee had occupied since long before white settlers arrived. The failure of these two respected leaders to compromise bred a hatred that led to a civil war within the Cherokee Nation, the tragedy of the Trail of Tears, and finally, the two factions actually battling each other on opposite sides of the Civil War. The Cherokee people were one of the most culturally and socially advanced Native American tribes in history. They had their own government, language, newspapers, and religion. But as John will say in this interview, the warrior culture offered few gradations between war and peace, all or nothing. Anyway, a lot to get into here about Native American civilization, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with John Sedgwick. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start off with a simple question. What made you want to write about rivalry between Cherokee chiefs?
Well, there's a story. A lot of of my own writing has been a matter of serendipity. I kind of go wherever my interest takes me in that moment. And I make it a policy never to write about anything twice. And I think that I've succeeded in that through a long career of many, many magazine articles and now quite a number of books. My last book was on Hamilton and Burr, and that covered obviously the period of the Revolution through the Federalist period of the government and surrounding areas. And I wanted to move the American story forward. And I got interested in the Civil War. And I was got curious about a Civil War battle in which I discovered that some Indians fought at the Battle of Fredericksburg. And that I was astonished to learn that there were Indians in it. Of course, everybody knows that there was the North against the South and that the Blacks came to fight mostly after emancipation in 1863. But I had not known that Indians were in it. And it turns out that there were as many as 18 tribes involved and as many as 30,000 Indians. Well, and they fought on both sides. Well, who knew? But there was one tribe that came in on both sides of the war, and only one tribe, and that was the Cherokee. And I thought, wow, how could that be? Why would a tribe come in on both sides, a single tribe fighting against itself? And the answer had to do with a pair of factions within the tribe that dated back over 30 years and could be traced to the core division for the Cherokee Nation on that great and terrible migration that is called the Trail of Tears. And those two factions were in turn traced back to two great men of the Cherokee people, one of whom was named The Ridge, for he who walks on mountaintops, and the other was a mostly Scottish gentleman named John Ross.
Well, I'm very curious about these two. And before we get into who these two are, something that I think the listeners might not know about, and I say listeners because really I'm projecting because it's me that I don't know about. Can you describe American Indian tribal politics? What does it look like from the Confederation level down to the tribal level and everything else? Because I think this is useful in understanding these two, their conflict, and how they enter in. Well, moreover, how their tribes enter into these American wars.
That's a really good question. It's a really hard question to answer. What we think of as the American Indians, or what we're thought of as Indians in the 19th century, in the period that I'm writing about them, the Native Americans today, are all of them traced back 20,000 years to an ice age along the Bering Straits. And this was actually, I didn't realize how this worked, but there was a land passage that opened up for a period of about 1,000 years, 20,000 years ago, during an ice age, because ice, as it forms, actually draws out water and reduces the area of that is covered in what is water once it turns into ice. So that there was a land passage across the Bering Straits, and Euro-Asian people, mostly Asian, then trooped across and spread gradually throughout North and South America both. And that, of course, the most famous civilizations that these Indians created were the Incas of Peru and the Mayans and Aztecs. But in the what became the United States, the Indians weren't so advanced that they produced what would be remembered as full civilizations that involved literally millions of people, that they were much more spread out, although they did cover just about every portion of the United States. There was no part of the United States that did not have Indians on it when Columbus called them all Indians in 1492 when he arrived in the Bahamas. That said, that the Indians in America can be divided into two broad classes. There were the Plains Indians to the west of the Mississippi, And then there were the woodland Indians to the east. These are the two major classifications of what we now call Native Americans. And that within those two classifications, the variations are relatively small. The woodlands Indians were groups of Indians that settled in what amounted to villages. Plains Indians were nomadic, and like the Apache and the Navajo, tended to roam mostly following the buffalo that they lived off of, and that they didn't actually settle in permanent towns or anything like it. To the east, however, these woodlands Indians, and I suppose the dominant tribe were the Iroquois, they went by a different principle that actually was not so different from what the Puritans established with their little townships when they came in the 1600s. And the distinction is important because the Eastern or Woodlands Indians were primarily a social people, and that they organized themselves, as I say, into towns with a modest government, usually involving a tribal leader, and then an extremely egalitarian group of villagers, everyone equal to everyone else, and the tribal leader governed by consensus and not by any kind of autocratic decree. And he wasn't elected, but was actually appointed by village elders who were, I think, at least for the Cherokee, all female. So the female chose the male leaders, but all the leaders were male. And there's a kind of an interesting social split there. But for the Cherokee, that all of their villages were arranged in a very similar way, which was that there would be a central council house, usually conic, with some open space beside for their ceremonies that usually included a fertility rite called the green corn dance, and then also for any war ceremonies that were conducted usually around an open fire. And then all the houses, really huts, of the individual members of that tribe would be sprinkled beside. Now, the tribe itself, all the villagers, were divided into clans. And clans, curiously enough, had a strange affinity, of course, for the Scottish traders who were some of the first to arrive to observe these people. The Scots had their clans. They understood the Indian clans of the Cherokee and easily adapted to them. All of the clans are an important element here because it was, in effect, your greater family. You had your individual family, but then you had the clan, and then the clan had a tribe, or rather it had a village, and then it had a tribe. And that these clans were dominant social forces, and they were all matrilineal, which is to say that a husband, when he married his wife, he joined the wife's clan. The wife did not join the husband's clan. And the wife was also the one who, in effect, possessed the children in the sense that the children would all join the wife's clan, not meaning their mothers, not their fathers. This set up an interesting dynamic within the Cherokee, and that an early observer named James Adair referred to it as a petticoat society, because the women had much more power and control than you found certainly in Puritan society, and chiefly in this, that it was the women who determined when a marriage was over. The man had no say in it, and the woman dictated this her decision in this way, which was she would take all the possessions that her husband had within their hut and simply put them outside the door. And when the husband came back and saw all of his stuff outside the hut, that was it for the marriage. The marriage was over, and there was no going back.
So in that case, would the husband typically go back to his, I suppose, his mother? I mean, by mother, I mean his matrilineal line. Is that how it would work?
That's right. He would be excluded from that clan. He would revert to his mother's clan. And the separation would be complete, and it would be done almost entirely without drama. And the woman was free to form another relationship. And indeed, the relationships weren't necessarily exclusive, and that there are many examples of one spouse or the other, usually the man having other wives. But that came later, once the Cherokee society started to not quite deteriorate, but loosen up under the influence of these white settlers coming in to take, quote unquote, take these women, female Cherokee, for sex, for relationships, sometimes for marriage. But those were not as long lasting as the relationships of a Cherokee man to a Cherokee woman. And it contributed to a loosening of these ties.
Yeah, that's interesting what you mentioned with the fractious nature of American Indian society. The very little that I do know from what historians have written is that this very same social structure that allows them to be adaptable, which is good when you're barely have enough subsistence to survive, you have to move around constantly. So this sort of social flexibility comes in handy. But at the same token, it becomes hard to unite in large enough forces to form any sort of opposition to white settlers and others, if I understand correctly.
Well, that's mostly true, yes. I mean, again, I would make the distinction between the Plains Indians and the Woodland Indians.
Okay.
The Plains Indians absolutely roved about. There was almost no permanence to their settlements, that they would set up their wigwams and they would and they could easily move them. There was no sense of place in the way that the Woodland Indians would have known it. The settlements of the Woodland Indians, at least as far as the Cherokee are concerned, was usually very well positioned. Often had water beside it, and often it was water with then low mountains and then high mountains in the distance. The panorama, the vista, was very important to these people in order to feel secure. In some ways, the mountain, of course, offered protection from other rival tribes that might want to sweep in to take over their territory. But it was also, I think, offered a kind of sense of access to the gods above. To the Cherokee, the spirits were as real to them as the wind, and that there was a wonderful pantheistic sense of their lives, by which all of the creatures of the forest had not just souls, but spirits that were essentially made them quasi people who could be communicated with, and that it was traditional for a Cherokee hunter to pray to his prey, P-R-E-Y, before releasing the arrow that would kill, say, a deer. You would ask the deer's permission to be killed and pray for that permission before you would let the arrow fly, because everybody was sort of in it together, and that you couldn't just take something, it had to be given. And there's one other thing that I would say about Cherokee society that's tremendously important and reflects the way that society was organized within the tribe, and that is, to the Cherokee, the balance of life was essential. And there's a reason why the women had a role in governance and that it wasn't left entirely to the men. And that reason was that they wanted all of life, and they saw all of life as in balance. In balance lay security and order and permanence. The sun had its moon, summer had winter, women had men, war had peace. All of these seemingly opposite notions were allied, that they each depended on the other. So that, in the tribe, there was a white chief of peace and there was a red chief of war, and that one rose up depending on the circumstances. If they were at war, that the war chief would take over; at peace, the peace chief would take over. And that it was, and that there was nothing so upsetting to the Cherokee as when there was a lunar eclipse, for example. And that one of the early observers I mentioned, James Adair, happened to be there one night when there was a lunar eclipse, and the moon gradually disappeared from the sky. Nothing could have been as terrifying as that for the Cherokee. And he said that all the Cherokee, seeing this at night, ran about shooting off guns, howling, throwing themselves onto the ground, wailing in just terrible, distressed grief, because suddenly the cosmos was out of order. And they quickly came up with a mythology to explain it, that a giant bullfrog had nibbled away at the moon to cause it to disappear, and that they were confident that the bulldog one day would return it, which of course the bullfrog did. The moon came back.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at Chumbacasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
All right, well, yeah, thanks for the overview. I mean, there's a lot to jump into there. And this background of American Indian society plays into the two people that you focus on. You mentioned The Ridge and John Ross. So could you tell me how you would characterize these two leaders? And I'm also very curious about John Rausch, how a man of Scottish background comes into American Indian society and even comes to lead it.
Well, it is fascinating and completely unexpected. And that was one of the great thrilling discoveries that I made when I started to trace the Cherokee back from the Civil War to this time of the terrible migration known as the Trail of Tears, because these two men stood on the opposite sides of it. And, intriguingly, just as we've spoken of the essential order of the Cherokee cosmos of sun and moon, well, these two men could not have been more different. That The Ridge was born in 1771. As I say, The Ridge is sort of shorthand for he who walks on mountaintops. He was born on the banks of the Hiwassee River, which curls about eastern Tennessee and dumps, as most rivers do, into the Tennessee River itself. And it's in the Smoky Mountains. It's that wonderful blue-green that you see everywhere in the Great Smokies. And I climbed up Dome to get this wonderful misty view that is almost identical because it's all national parkland. That is almost identical to what the Ridge himself might have seen in the 18th century. Anyway, he was born to a couple of Cherokee parents, Tokonatchui, I think is the way you would pronounce his mother, and that his father was known as Tarchi. He was primarily a hunter, and in the opening scene of the book, we see his mother giving birth while a shaman attends the fire looking for portents about the life that this newborn boy might lead. And it turns out that the Ridges was the fourth of four children At that point, his mother had given birth three times before, all of them sons, and all of them had died. And the mother was very concerned about the fate of her, this most recent boy. And the shaman was very concerned because the smoke in the hut seemed to be curving towards the north, which in the Cherokee cosmos, that's the place of witchcraft, is the place of darkness and ice. And he prepared this tea to counteract that. They would give him special powers that he could run like a fox and soar like an eagle and have other sort of unnatural powers. But the mother served him the tea, but also let him suck from her breast because she knew that he would need power, but he would also need love in order to fulfill his own destiny. Well, this man known as the Ridge grew up in one of the last sort of traditional Cherokee childhoods that was a matter of him being instructed by his father in the ways of the hunt, that he was that Cherokee boys customarily run around naked for the first 5, 6, 7 years of their life, so that they are exposed in effect to the hard knocks of nature. And that they learn, there were no Cherokee books, there was no Cherokee writing, that didn't come for another 30 or 40 years, so that they learned by doing, learned by seeing what happened after they tried something. It was kind of a life of experimenting. And I think that they learn it on their skin because they're scratched in a fall, that they're hurt when they slam into a tree or a tree branch that they hadn't seen coming, or that they were attacked by some animal, or they swam in cold water, that it was a life of immediate physical experience right on their skin. And it culminates for a young Cherokee male in this ceremony that I found absolutely appalling. And it's called a scratching ceremony, but scratching doesn't quite cover it. This is a deal where a boy enters puberty by standing naked on top of a rock in front of all of the Cherokee villagers, while a sort of grizzled old warrior takes out a fox bone that has been whittled down to having four incredibly sharp, needle-sharp teeth. And he takes that bone and he scratches it all over this boy's body. And that those needles are deep enough, they penetrate about 1/4 inch deep enough so that they draw blood. And that this warrior starts on one wrist, goes scratching slowly up the arm, across the back, down the other arm to the wrist, and then almost literally everywhere on the body after that, and leaving just this boy in a pool of blood just streaming down from everywhere. And it's important, it's essential that the boy not cry out, that this is, through this means, he is learning about the world, learning about hardship, learning about endurance. And these are the essential qualities of manhood. Once the ceremony is done, he's allowed to plunge into the water. The shaman puts on various balms of the ancient Cherokee medicine to heal his wounds. And then he is supposed to keep from women for 7 days after that, but on the 8th he can indulge himself freely as a man would, and with that he becomes a man in the eyes of the Cherokee. As they say in the Cherokee language, he becomes dreadful. Now, so that's how the Ridge grew up. John Ross, who was born 30 years later, was born on the other end, literally and figuratively, of the Cherokee Nation. That he was born on the banks of the Coosa River in a town called Turkeytown. Turkeytown was not Hiwassee. Hiwassee was the traditional Cherokee village with the council house and the fields, the agricultural fields spread out beside, and this ceremonial place that I mentioned. The Turkey Town was a place for merchants. This was it was a trading center. It was where whites met with Indians for exchanges. For pelts would be traded for guns or anything else of value, and so that it was a place where whites and Indians were integrated and were part of mercantile society. And John Ross did not grow up the way the rich did. He was not naked for his first years. His mother, who was Scottish, raised him to wear a yellow nankeen suit, a jacket and trousers that he was obliged to wear, even as all of his Indian pals were running about naked, enjoying life as kids did in the ancient Cherokee way. He was raised as a little Scottish boy because he was the son of Daniel Ross, who was a primary trader in the area, and the grandson of John MacDonald, who was one of the first and most impressive traders in the region, and one of the first truly rich men who had come into Cherokee society as a white man and profited extremely off of this trade with the Indians. So he comes from the Scottish line. He is 7/8 Scottish. He grows in full adulthood. He is no more than 5'6". He has a thick shock of brownish hair, and his skin is as white as mine. And he ended up speaking no Cherokee at all. And it's my suspicion that he may very well have spoken his English with a slight Scottish brogue, because that would have been the language that he had heard at home. He grew up reading English. He had English newspapers, Scottish newspapers in the house. He had the traditional romantic poets. He had the English Bible. Now, these were the materials that he learned from. He didn't learn his ways from the forest as the Ridge had done. And these two came into association in the War of 1812 that Jackson waged in that part of the country against a group of Creek Indians that had sided with the British, called the Red Sticks, and that the Ridge was a prominent warrior doing battle against the Red Sticks, and typically Ross was back at headquarters as pretty much a functionary who was recording the details of the battles as a bureaucrat might. He exposed himself to no harm whatsoever. The Ridge was the one actually to engage with the enemy, and it's said that he killed 6 of these Red Sticks warriors with his own bare hands, and the 6th one was an extremely dramatic story. It's something out of a Hollywood movie where he and his enemy were literally thrashing about in the water, each trying to duck the other under the water and drown him, both of them fighting to keep their breath. And finally, the Ridge was able to work his dagger loose and to shove the knife into the man's gut and kill him.
So for John Ross, how does he enter into Cherokee society? That's just fascinating that he seems to speak no Cherokee. And he grows up on the frontier. He grows up in contact with them. And the infrastructure of America hasn't spread to his home. But yeah, how is someone able to enter into society like this and command leadership when, in a sense, you're a foreigner entering into society with centuries and millennia old customs?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is that the Ridge, John Ross had some qualities and skills that the Cherokee Nation recognized that it needed as it had never needed them before. Chiefly, he could speak fluent English, and he could carry himself like first like a settler and later like an American once he had to deal with the American government in Washington. The Cherokee had faith in him to be able to represent their interests in a way that would win the respect of the government officials that they had to deal with. And so that it was his very foreignness in the Cherokee tribe that made him a character of such value. And indeed, as it happened, the Ridge was the first one to identify these qualities, because in that last battle, it was called the Battle of Horseshoe Cliffs, I think it was, in the southern Alabama. And it was the one that I mentioned where the Ridge did hand-to-hand combat with some of the Red Sticks. And Ross was back at headquarters writing down all the statistics of the battles. Well, the Ridge could see that this was a talent that would be of use, and he was the one to put him forward to possibly to have a governing role in the tribe, and that his first job, Ross's first job, was to be the translator for a man named Pathkiller, who was at that time the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, and proved to be so valuable as that in writing up these Cherokee letters and negotiating points with the federal government, that he ended up doing some of this on his own and creating for himself a reputation as a negotiator in his own right and a man of some power. And that was the origin of his sort of insinuation, really, into the leadership of the Cherokee Nation. Meanwhile, the Ridge was a figure of tremendous distinction, that he was an honored member of the tribe. He, because he had been such a successful and daring warrior, that he earned universal respect. He had a voice, apparently, that carried like no voice. It was a deep, powerful bass voice that I write in the book, could shake the leaves off the trees, as somewhat fanciful, but it was the voice that was always listened to in tribal councils where he sat, and that he was the one who was able to distill an argument down to its essence and be extremely persuasive and to win over the tribe to positions that it wasn't, in fact, ready for. And if you'd like, I could give you an example of that.
Yeah, sure.
Well, the first case where this came up was a remarkably central feature of Cherokee life, and it was known as blood law. Blood law is everything that you would imagine that it was. This is a matter of blood, of the essence. What blood law decreed was that if a Cherokee member of the Cherokee tribe was killed, that another death was required to balance it off and to square the ledger and essentially to redeem that death. And the remarkable part was that other death didn't have to necessarily be the person who was responsible for the death, namely the killer. Oftentimes the killer disappeared and couldn't be found, in which case another death was required from that person's clan. And so that somebody else had to be selected to be sacrificed in order to, as I say, to redeem the first death. Well, this led to terrible unfairness, that an innocent person was be killed because somebody else who ran off, who actually did commit the murder, was simply unavailable. And so innocents were being slaughtered. And often it led to this cycle of retribution where that it didn't actually end with a single death, but that death in turn needed to be redeemed and that the cycle of violence would continue. Well, the Ridge thought that this was no way to conduct any kind of society, and that he noticed that the whites had a different system for addressing murder, and it was involved something called a trial and evidence and testimony, and also this very peculiar notion called guilt, which is the singular responsibility for another person's death that would lead to punishment, and that without guilt, there was no punishment. Well, in the Cherokee way, guilt wasn't a factor. It didn't matter whether you were responsible for the death or not, meaning that guilt wasn't the issue. The overriding issue was that someone had to step forward to be killed in order to for that first death to be atoned. Well, the Ridge stood up in one of the early council meetings where he'd been selected to be one of the tribal representatives, and he persuaded the entire council to go against centuries, eons of Cherokee culture and do away with blood law and to move towards this white system of justice by which only the person responsible for the death should be held accountable for it. That was a dramatic change. And in fact, and it had consequences, which I can tell you about later.
Yeah, one other thing too, in terms of the background of these two characters, in terms of John Ross, it sounds like he's the ambassador between the Cherokee Nation and this emerging American government. How did you come across his story? And also, what did he have to do to, in a sense, prove himself to the Cherokee people to be their ambassador? I mean, you mentioned this incredible ritual where your body is scraped over and apparently, he didn't have to undergo that. But what did he have to do to prove himself to be their voice?
That's another excellent question. And frankly, the answer is a little bit mysterious. And I'll tell you why. I told you that his primary skills were his ability to represent the Cherokee Nation to this culture that was foreign to them, the white culture of words, of language, of documents, and bureaucracy. That was not the Cherokee way, but Ross was very adept with this, and that skill was immensely useful. Well, okay, but why did he then rise up into the leadership? And one reason that had to do with the fact that he and the Ridge together having been allied in this the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, that they had a fondness and a trust in each other that allowed them to forge this alliance to create for the Cherokee Nation something that they had admired from the Washington government. Ross and the Ridge were one of the few Cherokees who had ever actually visited Washington. In fact, probably one of the few Cherokees that had ever spent much time mingling in white society, where they were practically the only Indians there. And that the Ross and that Ross and the Ridge came to admire the American government, that just as the Ridge had admired the system of trials that that the whites had come up with in order to dispense justice, they admired the governments that had been created for the Americans with this system of three, where there was a chief executive and a Supreme Court and a legislative branch, and there was a measure of checks and balances among them, and that it formed a sort of three-legged stool on which society it could rest comfortably and securely. Well, Ross and the Ridge crafted a Cherokee constitution that mimicked the American one and followed most of its elements, adding only a few. One of them was that, interestingly enough, that you had to believe in God in order to be electable to the legislature or to hold any government post. That's a curious notion for a Cherokee nation that did not in the main believe in God. They believed in the spirits of their ancestors. They did not believe in the Christian God. They did not know the Bible. And so you might wonder, well, why was that a requirement? Well, the answer is that in the Cherokee society, as the white settlers encroached from the outside, and as these white settlers actually encroached on the inside too by marrying into the Cherokee Nation and producing children that were half white, that they had essentially introduced white culture deeply into the Cherokee Nation, but not contiguously. It didn't extend to everyone, and that gradually the Cherokee society divided in two, that there were what was called the full bloods, meaning the Cherokee who remained largely, if not entirely, Cherokee without any whites in their ancestry, and then the mixed bloods who did have white blood in them. And that these two groups became quite different in their orientation. The full bloods clung to the traditional ways, and they were basically people of the forest. And even though hunting was discouraged, that they because there were so many fewer animals left in the forest, that they still believed in hunting culture. The mixed bloods, by contrast, became farmers, and they tilled the soil. They limited their land to the cropland that they required to feed themselves and to sell any extra crops on a market to others. These mixed bloods were bringing in this other element that was probably the most. Of all the things that the whites brought, and they brought a lot, they brought guns, they brought viruses, and they brought Christianity. Those were very powerful, very transformative for the Cherokee. They brought something else, though, that I would argue is even more transformative, and that was capitalism. This notion that you could gain comparative advantage through a trade. You wouldn't just give goods to the people who needed them. You would sell goods in a market, trying to get as much value for them as possible while giving up something of the least value that you could manage to arrange. And that system of trading, where one benefits more than the other, introduced two things that were that changed the Cherokee. One was greed, the thought that you actually might be able to get more. And then with that more, that you could invest it, you could expand your crops, you could buy slaves that were themselves images of your status. And with that, with the differences that brought, you could create something that was radically new for the Cherokee, which was a class distinction between the moneyed class and the common class. And the moneyed class almost invariably were made up of these mixed bloods, and the common class was almost invariably made up of the full bloods. The common class the advanced class, the superior class, invariably was educated reading, writing, arithmetic. They knew English. They were likely to be Christian, and they were familiar with capitalist ways so that they could handle money and sums and do these trades to their advantage, that they could build up their property, make larger and larger estates, acquire more slaves to run them, and build up sort of mini empires within the Cherokee Nation, which had never existed before. It had always been a land where everyone was more or less equal.
Well, it sounds like we're coming to the watershed event, which is the Trail of Tears, and we'll get to that in a second. But this seems to be the big question of the American Indians. Once it becomes clear, when explorers and then white settlers come, they're not going to go away. So it seems the question is, how will Indian civilization continue? Will white settlers continue to push them to the margins until they're sequestered in small areas, which seems to be what is more or less happened, or if they accept certain conditions of white society, then they can live in their historical lands, but they have to accept certain Western accoutrements like Western dress, Christianity, the printing press, And that seems to be the spirit behind these treaties and terms. And the Cherokee go farther than any other Indian group, any other tribe, of actually accepting these terms, or at least the mixed peoples, as you described here. But despite that, it still doesn't work. And this is just one kind of quick tangent before we get to the Trail of Tears, where these two different views of the future really come clashing together. But something I'm curious about is your use of sources. How did you go about researching? Because, as you mentioned, the Cherokee language isn't written down until the early 19th century. And I'm sure there's plenty of biases in the sources, of, especially if they're white researchers of Indian people. So how did you go about doing this?
Well, you try to get as close to primary sources as you can. And yes, you're limited to before 1821, when the Cherokee language was invented and spread throughout the Cherokee Nation, literally like wildfire. It just went incredibly fast because this language proved to be very simple to write down. But before that, of course, yes, there was only the whites left records. And surely there is some distortion there. Interestingly, it was the whites, of course, had entirely separate interests, I think, from the Cherokee. The Cherokee didn't even you know, this town of that's called Hiwassee on the Hiwassee River probably didn't even have a name to the Cherokee, because it was just here. There are a lot of unlike other cultures, they left behind no images of themselves. There were no painters or sculptors, or there are no, you know, the equivalent of cave paintings or anything like that. They didn't seem to take an interest in recording what they saw, because they assumed, I think, that it was always going to be there. So why would anybody need to see this picture when they could just see the thing itself? When the whites arrived, of course, it was extraordinarily exotic culture, and that they wrote down everything with a great deal of fascination and with some precision. And I had no reason to doubt what they saw. It seemed to be that the only prejudice was in what they looked at. I think that what they saw was reliable, and many of them actually had a sort of scientific predisposition. There was this man, William Bartram, who was the son of the botanist to the king of England, and he went scrambling all over the Smoky Mountains to create records of the flora and fauna of the entire of the landscape. And I have every reason to think he did so accurately. But of course, you can't know. There's nothing really to check it against. And I think that another thing, and so that, you know, the primary records, of course, the battle reports, the early newspaper accounts, I would certainly turn and rely on those. There were the records from the period. This guy James Adair, that his account of the Cherokee was extraordinarily extensive. It ran, you know, I think 600-700 pages. And then there was this man much later, James Mooney, who documented much of the Cherokee ways in the 19th century, back when the last of the original Cherokee were finally dying out. He got all of their stories. But yes, it's a difficult effort, because it is absolutely true. You don't get both sides, and therefore you're limited to the white one. And you also do have to be careful not to succumb to the prejudices that they were likely to have. And the settlers, of course, valued white ways, and they, of course, tended to view the Indians that they were bent on, you know, stealing from or taking the lands of, inclined to belittle them and treat them as savages. And I had to check myself always to try and see things from the Indian point of view. For example, a lot of these trades that were so terribly one-sided, there was, all of Kentucky was traded for basically a room full of rifles. And you thought, you could think, what idiots, to do this. But in fairness, and from the Cherokee perspective, they didn't really recognize that land could be sold at all. So they couldn't see and wouldn't see that a paper with ink on it could possibly represent the purchase of land, because land was not to be purchased. And what was to be purchased were guns. And so they felt they were getting the better of the deal by getting a room full of guns. And you could sort of understand that. And I think that it was sort of in that principle of just trying to imagine life from the Cherokee perspective that made it easier. I'll give you another example, which is that the Cherokee were considered terrifying to the white settlers, and it was considered often, deeply unfair and primitive the way that the Cherokee would conduct their warfare, that they would come howling out of the woods, that they would beat, that they would bring down tomahawks on these settlers, that they would chop up the bellies of pregnant women, that they would throw children on the fire. I mean, this was horribly barbaric, or so you would think. But you have to recognize that from the Cherokee perspective, it made sense that they had, in effect, to be terrorists individually to scare the pants off of these settlers, because they couldn't come at them with numbers and with guns in the way that the settlers could. This was their sensible recourse, that they fought that way because that was the best way for them to fight. And on that score, it made a moral sense, even though it seems, morally abhorrent to chop at the womb of a pregnant mother.
All right. Well, thank you for that overview. I think that helps elucidate a lot of different things and seeing things from the Indian perspective. Now let's look at the political infighting amongst two different factions of the Ridge and John Ross. And we don't think about political infighting amongst American Indians. We often lump them together, even though cultures vary widely from tribe to tribe. So something you describe the Trail of Tears as is the result of a failure of politics. So what do you mean by that?
Well, as I say, that within the tribe, there were emerging as two classes of people. There were these aspiring mixed bloods, and then there were the traditional full bloods. The mixed bloods took as their representative the Ridge. He was probably the greatest of them. He had the finest house. He was a man of great integrity. He was a proud and successful and daring warrior, a man to be looked up to. And so he led this mixed blood faction. Ross, however, was the leader of the full bloods. The full bloods put their faith in him because they figured that he alone would be able to negotiate with the whites, as I said. Well, these two men were allied in creating the government. But as the white threat increased, as more white settlers were encroaching on the borders of the Cherokee Nation, and as more whites were actually insinuating themselves into the Cherokee family by marrying in, that the white threat became greater and greater and more imminent, and something had to be done. Well, ever since Jefferson, the American presidents had held out two options for the Cherokee people, and neither of them was attractive. Jefferson did, was the first to do this, to offer them the chance to go west and free up their lands for the whites. And they could go west as Cherokee, but they would go to lands that had never been Cherokee. Or they could stay in the east, but they would have to assimilate as Americans. They would have to adopt their farming ways. They would have to gradually Christianize, and they would have to be like whites. And there would be no Cherokee Nation in the east. They would no longer be any different from any other immigrant group, even though, of course, they were not immigrants at all. They would blend into the the melting pot of America. Well, those were two unpleasant alternatives. They could leave and stay Cherokee, or they could stay and be Americans. And that was the way it was put. Well, Ross insisted on a third option, that they stay as Cherokee, and that he had the full blood support behind him. Well, the full bloods were the ones that were very much rooted in their traditions, and they were also, it's fair to say, relatively ignorant about current events, and they'd probably never left the borders of their country to see how powerful and how imminent the white threat was. And they imagined they could just hunker down and stay there forever. And I think that the mistake that John Ross made was to play to his base and to say, okay, if the full bloods want this, I'm going to claim that it is possible. That way I will retain their political support. The Ridge, on the other hand, knew more about the world and was more respectful of the American might and recognized that the position of staying was untenable. The numbers were too great. The power was too much. They were never going to be able to stay there. And then another element came into the mix, and that was the discovery of gold in the Cherokee Hills of Georgia, which unleashed a pandemonium on the part of Georgians who were desperate to get this gold. Cherokee never valued gold particularly. Obviously, the Georgians did. Well, the Georgians wanted to take the gold and then take the land on which the gold was, whether the Cherokee were there or not. And that, in the 1830s, it created a really overwhelming pressure on the Cherokee that accelerated this pressure everywhere to get them to basically move. And so you had these two factions. You had the Ridge, who said, okay, I recognize that. We really need to leave. And he was also able to leave because he was a much more adaptable person who had money. The Fullbloods really couldn't leave. They were so used to where they had been, it was unimaginable to start again elsewhere. Well, here's where the failure of politics came in. Because the Ridge, as I say, spoke no English. John Ross spoke no Cherokee. That went deeper than you would think, that not only could they not communicate to each other, but then they couldn't really exchange ideas or values or points of view. That the Ridge actually had a couple of relatives, his son and his nephew, who joined with him in the leadership of what became the Ridge faction. They were people who were even more than the Ridge was himself. They were extremely conversant in white society. They were highly educated. They'd actually married white women themselves. They were like Keats and Shelley in terms of their eloquence and their knowledge of poetry. And they really did pass in white society. They could have gone anywhere. And so that for them, the prospect of going out to Oklahoma and starting over was not nearly so forbidding. Before for the native Cherokee, for these full bloods, much harder. Well, what did the Ross do in the face? What did John Ross do in the face of the Ridge's beliefs? Well, he did this thing, which was the biggest mistake of all, which was to call him a traitor and to have him banished from the government. And that as a traitor, in fact, treason was in the Cherokee, that was a capital crime. He was threatened with execution. Well, that ends politics right there. That when you accuse your opponent of treason and make that a hanging offense, that pretty much ends the discussion. That you've utterly devalued the opposing side. You're never going to listen to them. They're going to hate you for what you've done. They're not going to listen to you. And that's when the politics of the nation stopped. And the two of them went into rival camps, and this personal disagreement about the fate of the Cherokee turned into a blood feud that led to a civil war on the issue. There were two warring camps who could not see eye to eye on this matter. And so that when the migration finally came and that the two groups had to gather together once more in Oklahoma, they simply did not. And they went to separate corners of the nation and fought bitterly. And it was that fight that really continued all the way through to the American Civil War 30 years later.
So why do you think this story has gone untold?
It's fascinating to think. I think for the same reason that we know the Cherokee from the perspective of these white traders like John Adair, who wrote everything down, we know our history from the perspective of the white authors who wrote everything down. The Cherokee did not write these things down. Even when they got their language, they didn't turn to history. They did turn to politics, and the Ridge family wrote brilliantly their political opinions. No one wrote the Cherokee history, and I think that the Cherokee history largely has gone unwritten by the Cherokee themselves. So we get this white perspective. And with the white perspective, of course, comes white government, the white government perspective. We get the Jackson perspective. We get the perspective of all the many presidents who dealt with the Cherokee, and the tended to view the Cherokee as a monolithic people without particular distinctions. And so nobody actually took into it. They certainly knew John Ross because he was, the principal chief for so many years. They did not know what the John Ross was struggling with the Ridge, and they did not realize that there were two factions on this issue of migration. They assumed that there was only one resistant one. They didn't recognize that there was another one that was powerful, that was accommodating. And indeed, it was that other one, the accommodating one, that wrote the Treaty of New Echota, which was the document that Jackson seized on to give him legal permission to send the Cherokee west, whether they wanted to go west or not. And he dispatched those 7,000 American troops to take 15,000 Cherokee out of their homes, march them down to the river to put them on keelboats or force them along the trails of earth to tramp their way all the way to Oklahoma, which was 800 miles distant.
Well, that's definitely one of the darkest chapters in American history, the Trail of Tears, for very good reason. But let's not have this episode end here, obviously. First of all, could you tell me, are there any lessons to be gained from this story of this factional infighting causing the downfall of the Cherokee people and this tribal feud that continues to the Civil War? So are there any lessons? And then second, could you tell me about your own personal family connection to the story and how there is actually a bit of reconciliation?
Yes, and in fact, the answers to those two questions are joined. As you suggested in the second question, that to my amazement, that I had a personal connection to the story that I had never imagined while I was writing the book. That the Sedgwicks, my family, are a New England family and have been a New England family for many generations. Incredibly enough, the first Sedgwick came to what became the United States way back in 1636. And for the most part, we hunkered down in New England, or certainly in the greater Northeast. And as I had thought of it, it never had anything to do with Indians of any sort. Well, once the book was done, I happened to take a little bit more interest in an ancestor of mine named Catherine Mariah Sedgwick, who was an early novelist, who had written a book called Hope Leslie, and one of its themes was was a marriage between an Indian woman and a Native American man, not of the Cherokee, but it turned out to my surprise, that story was based on something that involved the Rich family. And I mentioned that the two of the descendants of the Rich, his son John Rich and his nephew Elias Boudinot, both married white women. They had gone to Cornwall, Connecticut to be educated at what amounted to the only college that was available to them, a place called the Mission School. And there they had fallen in love with each of them with a leading white daughter of one of the first families of the town. And well, one of them was a woman who married Elias Boudinot was named Harriet Gold. Well, I had known all about the Harriet Gold and Elias Boudinot story and just how astonishing that was all alone, because even though the town had made a big point of accepting the Cherokee and educating them, they were horrified when Boudinot wanted to marry one of the white women in town, and that they just, that's where they drew the line. And that, in fact, even the Gold's family was appalled, and her brother, Stephen, whom she was very close to, actually burned her in effigy in the town square while Harriet watched, appalled from a basement window. But they did marry. Well, here is the thing. Harriet Gold was the granddaughter of a woman named Sarah Sedgwick. Sarah Sedgwick was the sister of Theodore Sedgwick. Theodore Sedgwick, that was an early speaker of the house, six generations back from me, who was at the very center of this family graveyard that we have in Stockbridge, where the Sedgwicks settled for many years. Harriet Gold was a Sedgwick, which meant that the Sedgwicks had married into the Cherokee tribe and also into this first family that I had been writing about, the Ridges. Well, this was astonishing to me, and I looked up in the family genealogy, and sure enough, there was the full record of it, of Harriet's marriage to Boudinot and the children that they had produced, where this had happened, in the manner identical to all the other genealogical references and entries in that book. I had never known this. I knew plenty about the Sedgwick family. I had written about six generations of the Sedgwick family in an earlier book of mine called In My Blood that traced the family back to Theodore and recounted everything that I thought was of interest in that period. I had never heard about the Cherokee connection. Why do I mention this? Well, I mention this because Cherokee history is hidden history. It's ignored history. It's history that's assumed to be on the other side of the world that has nothing to do with us. It might as well be dead and buried as far as most Americans are concerned. What my story, my personal story, reveals is that no, they're not on the other side of the earth. This is America, and we are all family here, but we are all relations, albeit often distant relations. Immigrants of every type marry other immigrant families, ethnicities marry ethnicities, people from different areas marry together. Americans are one huge, sprawling family, and no part is disconnected from any other. And even the Cherokee, long ago as the Trail of Tears might be, is still actually in some way a part of me, but it's a part that I didn't know. And once I learned that I myself had a connection to the Cherokee, it really made this whole story so much more immediate and, in fact, much more personal and meaningful. And I think that's what's been true for me of this book generally, that my discovery of the Cherokee, and mind you, I knew nothing about the Cherokee when I started, that it is so illuminating about the full range of the American experience, that the treatment of the Cherokee that is in some way an extension of the treatment of Blacks and many other minority groups in this country, and it shows that it's important to see these stories from the other side, to learn what it is to be a minority culture, to identify that culture, to treasure that culture, and to try and integrate that culture into the larger culture of America, difficult as that may be. And the Cherokee story is really all of our stories. It's about how to be in this place called America. The Cherokee, of course, come at it from a unique perspective virtually, because they were always here and the Americans were the immigrants. But the prospect and the difficulty is the same, that they have to be part of this great union, and their struggle is everyone's struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for tying that into, I think, the bigger story of America. And it's all these different groups converging together and not the story of this particular immigrant group that I suppose other European groups come into, and then that strengthens a river current. But it's a lot more diverse than that. Well, John, thank you for sharing all of this with us. This is a field that I don't know much about, so I was really interested to learn more about this and the particulars of American Indian society that I think a lot of us gloss over. So if people want to learn more about you and your writings, where is the best place to find you online?
I have a website. It's John Sedgwick, and that's Sedgwick, Sedgwick, no E in the middle, or no extra E in the middle, .biz, www.johnsedgwick.biz. And I have on my website, you know, more about the book, more about other books that I've written, and I added actually a lot of my magazine work, which was made up the bulk of my career for maybe the first half of it. And so you can see a lot about me there, and I'd be flattered if anybody took a look.
Absolutely. I'll include that in the show notes so people can check it out. John, thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to this interview with John Sedgwick. As always, the show notes to this episode can be found at historyunplugpodcast.com. You can also submit a question to me about history that I would be glad to answer, or at least consider, for Q&A episodes that appear once a week. Thanks for listening, and see you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to parthenonpodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.